From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's too close to call. The results of the presidential election now depend on Florida, where Bush and Gore are neck and neck and votes are still being counted. Today, as the election cliffhanger continues, an exclusive extended interview with the president of the United States. Can I say what
now,
some people...
Let me just finish. Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, but and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. People around the country awoke today to find yesterday's presidential election is still too close to call, with the outcome hinging on a fraction of a percent of the vote in a Florida recount. Shortly after 2 a.m., the networks projected Texas Governor George W. Bush as the winner in Florida. That state's 25 electoral votes would have given him the necessary votes to defeat Vice President Al Gore in the Electoral College. But as late precincts and absentee ballots came in, Bush's margin eroded in Florida to fewer than 1,000 votes, small enough to trigger a recount under state law and put Florida back into the undecided column. Without a decision in Florida, Gore leads the projected count in the Electoral College by 14 votes, 260 to 246. The only other state yet to have projected winner this morning is Oregon, with 7 electoral votes. To win, a candidate needs 270 electoral votes. Gore had been prepared to give a concession speech to thousands of supporters outside his headquarters in Nashville, Tennessee, about 3 a.m. He already had phoned Bush, who was watching the returns in Austin, the Texas capital, to congratulate him on his win. But at the urging of his Florida campaign staff, the vice president retracted his concession. Gore campaign chief Bill Daley told supporters standing in the rain in Nashville that with recount pending, quote, our campaign continues. Gore holds a slight lead in the popular vote nationwide with more than 95 million ballots cast. Meanwhile, Republicans held off a strong Democratic challenge to retain narrow control of Congress, but Democrats scored key victories when First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton won a Senate seat from New York and Missouri voters elected a dead man to the Senate. Hillary Rodham Clinton triumphed over Republican Congressmember Rick Lazio, while the late Democratic Governor Mel Carnahan, who died in a plane crash in October but remained on the ballot, beat Republican incumbent Senator John Ashcroft, one of the most conservative members of the Senate. Carnahan's widow, Jean, will be appointed by Missouri's new Democratic governor to fill his seat. All 435 House seats and 34 of the 100 Senate seats were at stake in yesterday's voting, and Democrats fell just short of the 7 House seats and 5 Senate seats they needed to reclaim congressional majorities for the first time since 1994. The narrow working margins for Republicans, however, raise questions about how effectively they'll be able to govern as a new president tries to implement his agenda over the next 2 years. It's the first time since the 1920s that Republicans held power in the House and Senate for 4 consecutive congressional sessions. And if Republican Texas Governor George W. Bush wins the presidency, it would be the first time since 1953 to 55 that they would control the White House, Senate, and House. In the Senate, several Republican incumbents fell in addition to Ashcroft, with Republican Senator William Roth of Delaware, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, the most prominent. Roth lost to popular Democratic Governor Tom Carper, who'd won 10 statewide races in Delaware, and Minnesota Senator Rod Grams fell to Democratic department store heir Mark Dayton. The races of incumbent Republicans Slade Gorton of Washington and Spencer Abraham of Michigan were still too close to call. But let's talk about the women in the Senate. They will increase by 3 and possibly 4. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton easily won the New York Senate seat. Joining her in the winner's circle is Jean Carnahan, widow of Mel Carnahan, the Missouri governor. In addition, Congresswoman Debbie Stabenow has defeated incumbent Spence Abraham in the Michigan Senate race. That just just in. In Washington, again, incumbent Slade Gorton holds a slight lead over Maria Cantwell. There are currently 9 women in the U.S. Senate, 6 Democrats, and 3 Republicans. If Cantwell wins, Washington would join California and Maine as the only states with 2 women senators. And Republicans captured an open Democratic seat in Nevada and toppled Virginia Democratic Senator Charles Robb, who lost to former Virginia Governor George Allen. In the House, Republicans captured open Democratic seats in Pennsylvania, New York, Missouri, Virginia, while vulnerable Republican incumbents pulled out wins in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Indiana, and North Carolina. Democrats defeated one of their top targets, incumbent California Republican James Rogan, a House prosecutor at President Clinton's impeachment trial. But they also suffered a defeat in Connecticut, where incumbent Sam Gaidenson, ranking Democrat on the House International Relations Committee, was a loser. Tammy Baldwin, the only openly lesbian Congress member, has just eked out a win from Madison, Wisconsin.
Sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You're listening to Democracy Now!'s Election 2000, The Morning After, including an exclusive extended interview with the President of the United States.
Can I say what some people...
Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this.
Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers.
Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on. Sail on, O mighty ship of state, to the shores of need.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!'s Election 2000, The Morning After. In just about 15 minutes, we'll play the entire exclusive extended interview with the President of the United States. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, Amy, and an amazing 24 hours since the polls opened yesterday morning, not only here in the United States, but in the United States' last major colony, Puerto Rico, which was also voting yesterday. And there the pro-statehood government was basically voted out. Sila Calderon, the candidate for the Popular Democratic Party, the pro-Commonwealth Party, won, eked out a victory, and Carlos Romero Barceló, Puerto Rico's only non-voting representative in Congress, was also defeated, and he's also a pro-statehood advocate, and he was defeated. So the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico has recaptured the governor's house and its only representative in Congress.
Well, it's been an exciting election night, to say the least, and it's not over yet for a lot of people around this country who have not made it to bed. Today, we still don't know who the next president will be, and the state of Florida has the presidential election still in its hands. Last night, around 3:30 in the morning, all the networks declared Texas Governor George Bush had won Florida in the presidential race. Around 2 in the morning, Vice President Al Gore called Bush from his hotel room and conceded the race to him. Gore then got into his car, concession speech in hand, for the 10-minute ride to the Army Memorial Plaza, where his supporters and the press were waiting to hear his concession speech. But 2 blocks from the plaza, the Gore campaign's field director paged the motorcade to let Gore know that Bush was only leading in Florida by 600 votes, with thousands more still to be counted. Gore met with his campaign staff around 2:30 a.m. Gore called Bush once again and took back the concession. The motorcade turned around and went back to the hotel.
And Gore wasn't the only one taking back things. The networks kept taking back their predictions on Florida. Something has to be done about these networks projecting these winners. They did it twice wrongly on Florida, and I think that certainly put a lot of Americans through a roller coaster. But we're faced now with a 1,600-vote margin by Bush so far in Florida, and a 200,000-vote margin for Gore in the popular vote. So those who were predicting this possible split in the electoral and popular vote, it may turn out that it's Al Gore who won the popular vote, but George Bush who wins the presidency.
Well, let's go to Tampa right now to the eye of the storm. Rob Lori is standing by. He is the news director of community radio station WMNF. It's nice to have you with us, Rob. I assume you haven't gotten much sleep.
Yeah, it's been just a few hours. I got a few hours, but good morning to you and good morning to Juan. I'm glad to be here. It's interesting, Juan, you talked about the roller coaster. Florida's the theme park state, some people think, and we've certainly been on a roller coaster all night. I can tell you the latest.
Tell us the latest.
And that is that George Bush's lead over Al Gore here in Florida has shrunk a little bit to about 1,400 votes. The recount is underway. And one recount back in 1988 took 8 days before it was conceded. And that recount was all about absentee ballots. And that's what this recount, I think, is going to be about ultimately. Who is able to get more absentee ballots to their supporters, the Republicans or the Democrats? In 1988, here in Florida, we went to bed thinking that Connie Mack, that Buddy McKay, rather, had won. He was a Democrat running for the United States Senate. We woke up the next day and found out that because of the absentee balloting, Connie Mack was pulling ahead. The GOP really has this down to a fine art. In fact, one of the local legislators, a Democrat, who lost in yesterday's election here in the Tampa Bay area, said to us last night, she said, "We Democrats still haven't figured out how to use absentee ballots to our favor." And I think it's going to come down to that, although as they're counting the absentee ballots now in South Florida, it's swung a little bit back in the favor of Al Gore.
Now, as I understand it, there was also a heavily Democratic area where there were some major problems at the polls in terms of people voting. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, one. There's just a few major Democratic areas here in Florida, but they pack a lot of punch. And one of those areas is Southeast Florida, West Palm Beach, Dade County, Broward County. In Palm Beach County right now, lots of voters are calling in to the county elections office saying that they were confused about yesterday's punch card ballot system. And I'm sure most people are familiar with the punch card ballot system. They say that when they went in to vote yesterday, they thought they were voting for Al Gore, but the ballot was so confusing, they thought they ended up then voting for Pat Buchanan in Palm Beach County. Now, this would be significant because this is usually a Democratic stronghold. And what I did was I went on the Supervisor of Elections office statewide, and I looked at the Buchanan vote. Statewide, the Buchanan vote is about 0.3%. If you look at, though, in Palm Beach County, it's twice that. It's more than twice that in Palm Beach County. Now, I can't say that I've studied, you know, where the hotbeds of Buchanan support are, but there does seem to be a 50% jump in Palm Beach County, and that's what people are complaining about. They complained that they thought they were voting for Al Gore, but that they ended up voting for Pat Buchanan. In fact, some people asked that they get another ballot and be able to vote again because the ballot was so confusing in Palm Beach County.
So it's amazing to believe that an entire presidential race may depend on a couple of thousand votes in a few counties in Florida.
Yeah, it's what people say all the time. Your vote counts. I think the other thing about Florida that we're noticing is that in the polls a few days ago, Ralph Nader was up by about 4 or 5%. People thought that Nader was really going to ruin this election for the Democrats. In the last few days, though, we've seen that Nader support melt, and it's dropped. Right now in Florida, Nader has about 1.6% of the vote as the ballots were counted last night. So he peaked maybe a week or two ago, but it looks like the people in Florida that were Nader supporters, and I've talked to a lot of them personally, who said, you know, I just don't want to waste my vote. I just can't stand the thought of having George Bush in office. So when it came down to going in that voting booth, they decided to go with Gore rather than with Nader.
And Jeb Bush and voter fraud, history of it in Florida?
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far.
I didn't connect the two, but Jeb Bush being the brother of the of the governor, George Bush.
You know, Amy, this was supposed to be a slam dunk. The Republicans have pretty much controlled Florida since the Nixon years. And this was supposed to be an easy one for George W. Bush with his brother as governor. His brother has not done many things that have pleased many people. He's got a very poor environmental record. His record on affirmative action is abysmal. And so I think a lot of people are angry at him. And you know, just by virtue of the fact that Florida's in play and it wasn't a slam dunk for George W. Bush, I think shows the level of anger that many people here in Florida have for Governor Jeb Bush.
Did Bill Clinton do any campaigning for Al Gore in Florida?
No, he didn't. There was a lot. Gore was here more than Bush was, but no, Bill Clinton really didn't do any campaigning for Al Gore here in Florida. We didn't see him.
But Rob Laurie, finally, on that issue of voter fraud, explain the history in Florida, the especially recent history, since this really matters for right now.
It does, and practically during every election that I've been here, there have been some complaints of some type of voter fraud. Frankly, the officials have not taken them very seriously. The most serious case took place a few years ago in voting for the mayor of Dade County. There were allegations that there was voter fraud there. It was proved. Some people were put on trial. So in Dade County, it certainly was a problem. Dade County is an interesting place. People think of it as a Cuban-American stronghold and therefore a right-wing stronghold. Not true. Florida is very diverse. There's many more people here than just Cuban-Americans. The Puerto Rican population is strong. Lots of people come from Colombia and Venezuela and other parts of Latin America. And so the Latin vote there is probably about 50-50 Republican-Democrat. The African-American vote was very strong yesterday in Dade County. And last I looked, I'm not really sure, but Dade County, I think, went to Al Gore. But I think that Dade County has a history of that. You can bet that they're not going to take these allegations lightly this time around. In fact, the Democratic Party in the state of Florida is saying that if people noticed any voting irregularities, to call the Democratic Party. They've got lawyers. They're willing to look into this and maybe take this to the lawsuit level.
The voter fraud case ended up ousting the Dade County mayor. Rob Laurie, thank you for being with us from Tampa, Florida, MNF, WMNF News Director, community radio station that runs Democracy Now! In Tampa area. We're also joined on the phone now across the country by Alexander Coburn, who is a columnist, well-known political analyst. His latest book with Jeffrey St. Clair is Al Gore, A User's Manual. What is happening in California right now?
Oh, well, California went strongly for Gore, Amy. North of me, though, Oregon, it looks as though Nader, I don't know, I mean, you may have a little more up-to-date information than I do. Looks as though Oregon is still in contention, and the Nader vote would have made a difference there. Although, of course, Oregon doesn't have enough votes to make a difference to the ultimate outcome. But certainly looking down the road, when people start recriminations against the Nader campaign, and the Nader campaign, if it goes on, says we did make a difference and we can make more of a difference, I think that's very important.
Important to point out, the national figure, it looks like Nader got around 2.6 million votes, will come in at about 3%, which means it will not hit that 5% bar.
Yes, and apparently the highest percentage for Nader came from the state of Alaska, where he got 10% of the vote. Now, I don't know if that's a lot of Nader supporters or a lot of vote swapping that went on from Alaska, because Bush, of course, won the state by 60%.
Well, I think Alaska's got a pretty strong libertarian independent tradition, and I think the Nader vote, people always reckoned it was going to be pretty strong up there. I think that this 5% figure, I mean, obviously a lot of Nader people will be disappointed. I thought it would be a mixed blessing, actually, because it would have brought a lot of money, and that would have meant a lot of fighting. But I think, certainly going on people I talked to in California, what actually Nader predicted to me months ago did happen, that at the very last minute, people who'd been strongly committed to Nader decided, just like your someone was saying from Florida, they just couldn't do it and went back into the Gore column. By and large, I think looking at it, if you like gridlock, which I personally do, I think it's quite a comforting result. We don't want bold innovations given the conservative temper of most of the politicians in Washington, and if they're tied up in this closer thing, I think the prospect for gridlock and no great onrushes at Social Security and the rest of it is not a bad thing.
It looks like you had some interesting initiatives in California, strategies in the war on drugs also in the ballot in a number of states. In California, exit polls indicate victory for the state proposal mandating drug addiction treatment and probation, not prison, for an estimated 24,000 nonviolent drug users per year.
Well, that's Prop 36. Yes, it won by, according to what I saw this morning, it won pretty handsomely. I think that one, actually, there's some confusion there as to whether it is totally nonviolent people who will go through those programs, and there could be some problems with that later on. But certainly, it's an indication that people really don't buy the whole war on drugs approach and are sick of it. And I think there are a bunch of other initiatives across the country, and I don't know the results of those. But certainly, looking at the California result, it was a very, very strong yes to diverting of nonviolent offenders into treatment rather than putting them in behind bars.
And also, apparently, California, along with Michigan, voters roundly defeated initiatives for school voucher proposals.
Just went down big time. Absolutely big time. And I don't know, but I was told, actually, that by and large, the choice abortion issue didn't figure that large in people's concerns. So I don't. That was anecdotal. I don't know whether that's really true. And that what really people went for was they wanted a tax cut, they wanted money in their pockets, and they and on the Gore front, they were worried about Social Security. Though looking at the figures in Florida, that seems a little in doubt.
Now, Alex, one last question. In terms of the turnout, what is the turnout being reported in California?
You know what? I don't know that. I think by and large, people the turnout figures, people don't concentrate on that in the early part of the conversation any more than they really take a look at the polls. It seems to me, basically, it was a bad day for the polls, except for, I think, the Zogby poll. He called it for Gore. Most of the other ones, I think, went fairly strongly for Bush, did they not?
Well, we also have the figures in from the House and the Senate, at least at this count, 220 Republicans, 210 Democrats, two independents in the House, and in the Senate, 50 Republicans, 48 Democrats, and two undecided, to say the least. We are talking very close situation, and at a number of levels, it's all too close to call. Alexander Coburn from California speaking to us, co-author of Al Gore, A User's Manual, as well as Rob Lori from Tampa, Florida. When we come back, we're going to look at initiatives around the country where they went, but then for the bulk of the program, the exclusive extended interview with the President of the United States. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. It is still too close to call with recounts in Florida right now going on where the battleground for the presidency looks like it will end up. We are going to turn right now to looking at initiatives for a few minutes before we go on to the full interview that Democracy Now! Was able to do with President Clinton yesterday, perhaps his longest interview on radio that he's done. We're joined by Galen Nelson, Executive Director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. Galen, we only have a few minutes. Go through the most important ballot initiatives around the country, please.
Sure, Amy. Thanks for having me on. Very briefly, I think three themes emerged yesterday. Clearly, their voters struggled over their decision at the top of the ticket. But they did decisively address a range of issues from gun control to education, tax and health care reform, and that tells us much about what to expect on future ballots. While voters were clearly divided at the top across a range of issues, voters actually split their support for health care reform, tax reform, gay rights, marijuana policy, and more. And finally, the last emerging theme is that money, especially late contributions from special interests, played a critical role in defeating some progressive ballot measures, including sweeping health care reform in Massachusetts, where proponents of universal health care were outspent nearly 25-1. In Oregon and Missouri, where opponents of clean money campaign finance reform launched expensive campaigns to defeat those measures. And finally, in growth limits, where developers in Arizona and Colorado also outspent their opponents by significant margins to defeat voter-approved growth plans. There were some very clear-cut victories for progressives on public education. As your previous guest mentioned, not only did voters reject private school voucher measures in California and Michigan, but they also approved reduction in class size measures in Washington and a measure to measures to increase school funding in California, Oregon, and Colorado. Voters in Oregon also rejected a measure that would have tied teacher performance to pay. Voters rejected an anti-choice measure in Colorado, a so-called informed consent amendment that would have erected further barriers to reproductive freedom. Voters passed two critical gun control measures in Oregon and Colorado that will close the so-called gun show loophole. But voters really did split their support on a range of issues. On tax measures, voters seemed to approve more simple tax cuts, but rejected schemes that would have showered their greatest benefits on the wealthy and special interests.
Also, apparently in Arizona, they did approve the measure ending bilingual education and mandating one-year English immersion?
That's correct. And also approved a measure in Arizona that will use tobacco settlement money in that state to fund health care for the under and uninsured. Voters split on gay rights. Voters passed a non-discrimination law in Maine and rejected a particularly mean-spirited measure in Oregon.
And finally, because we're short on time, there was one in Alabama where Alabama entered the 21st century and ended its ban on interracial marriage.
That's correct. So well, a very long night for initiatives as well.
Galen Nelson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Galen Nelson, who is with the Ballot Initiative Center in Boston, Massachusetts. And we will go back to review some of those tomorrow on Democracy Now! But right now we go to the bulk of the show, which is the exclusive extended interview with President Clinton. Yesterday he called in to our radio station here in New York, Pacifica Radio's WBAI, to shore up the vote for Vice President Al Gore and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton. I don't think he expected to spend 30 minutes defending his administration's record. The White House said he had 2 minutes, actually, when he first called, or when the White House called, and they said, "Would you like to speak to the president?" I was a little taken aback. We had not expected this call. I said, "The president of what?" They said the president of the United States.
Amy, the president cold calling radio stations. You know it was a close race.
And so we had the chance to talk to him. I went into the La Nueva Alternativa, which was the program on the air at the time yesterday morning, hosted by Gonzalo Alberto. And he was more than willing to join me in questioning the president of the United States. And this is the interview that ensued. Mr. President, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations and that they are, at this point, feel that their vote doesn't make a difference?
There's not a shred of evidence to support that. That's what I would say. It's true that both parties have wealthy supporters, but let me just give you the differences. Let's look at economic policy. First of all, If you look at the last 8 years, look where America was 8 years ago and look where it is today. We have the strongest economy in history, and for the first time in 30 years, the incomes of average people and lower-income working people have gone up 15% after inflation, the lowest minority unemployment ever recorded, the highest minority home ownership, the highest minority business ownership in history. That's our record. If you look at our proposals, what do we propose to do? We propose a tax cut that helps average people for child care, for long-term care, for paying for college tuition, for retirement savings. We propose to invest large amounts of money in education, health care, the environment, in our future. And we propose to keep paying down the debt because that keeps interest rates lower. What do the Republicans propose? A tax cut that's three times as big. Most of it goes to very wealthy people. The top 1% of the people get as much money as they would spend on health care, education, and the environment combined. They propose to privatize Social Security, and if you add the two things together, we'll be back in deficits, which means the economy will go downhill and interest rates will be higher for ordinary people.
President Clinton.
That's just one example. You asked the question. There's not.
Right.
Look at campaign finance reform. The Democrats are for it. The Republican leadership kills it.
Well, let me just
look at the environment. We got the cleanest environment in history, the best environmental record in history. The Republicans want to reverse our environmental record. So give me, you can't give one example of where both parties are dominated by large corporations and therefore there's no difference. The American people's lives are a lot better than they were 8 years ago. The truth is there's an ideological struggle between those who believe that the best way to grow the economy is to give more money to the wealthy and the Democrats who believe that the wealthy will make more money if average people do better.
President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. That is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there, and when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications. And, see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence. And I've never had the time actually to sit down myself and review that case. I know it's very important to a lot of people, maybe on both sides of the issue, and I think I owe it to them to give it an honest look-see. So part of my responsibilities in the last 10 weeks of office after the election will be to review the requests for pardons and executive clemencies and give them a fair hearing, and I pledge to do that.
And you will give an answer in his case?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll decide one way or the other.
And finally, do you support a moratorium on the death penalty, given these studies that show how racist it has been, it has been applied
I certainly support what the governor of Illinois did, because there was clear evidence in Illinois that a lot of mistakes had been made. In the case of the federal government, I have asked the attorney general to conduct a comprehensive review and to let me and to report back to us on the racial disparities and on any question of guilt, on adequate assistance of counsel, on all those things to determine whether there should be a moratorium. And I haven't gotten her findings yet. Now, so far, the only two cases which have come up have been deferred while we do this study. And so when that comes in, and if it comes in while I'm still in office, then I'll make a judgment. And if it doesn't, I think that the next president, I would hope, would make the same decision based on the merits, based on what the evidence shows. The disturbing thing to me is that there's not only an apparent racial disparity on death row, but also in the federal government, but also way over half the cases come from a relatively small number of the U.S. attorney's offices, which is, it's disturbing. But again, let me just say this. If you're concerned about that, that's a good reason to vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman and Hillary for the Senate, and for the people in New Jersey who can hear you for John Corzine, because we know the Democrats care about these issues, and we know they're not very important to the Republicans.
Vice President, that's another
example of another reason you ought to vote for the Democrats.
Gore supports the death penalty.
He does, but...
And Lieberman.
Yes, they do. But there's a difference in supporting it and thinking that you would carry it out even if you thought the system was fundamentally unfair. His opponent...
But
the studies are not complete, because the studies have to... What the Attorney General is doing is not just looking at everybody that's been convicted, but everybody that could have been charged that wasn't. There's a lot more stuff that needs to be done, and it may confirm the initial view of who's on the death row. But I think what you ought to look at that as compared with Texas, for example, where there was evidence that lawyers falling asleep in their trials were not enough to deter Texas from continuing to carry out the death penalty, which I thought was unacceptable. And so I think that if you're interested in having somebody that at least has the capacity to look at the fairness of this, you only have one choice.
Well, I guess many people were quite disturbed that when you first ran for president, you went back in the midst of your campaign to Arkansas and presided over the execution of a mentally impaired man.
Yeah, but let's go back to the facts here. He was not mentally impaired when he committed the crime. He became mentally impaired because he was wounded after he murdered somebody. And the law says that it's your mental state at the time you committed the crime. That's something no one ever says that when they talk about it. Had he been mentally impaired when he committed the crime, I would never have carried out the death penalty because he was not in a position to know what he was doing. That is not what the facts were. Secondly, if I had not gone home, I would have been accused of putting a tough decision off on somebody else.
President Clinton, my name is Gonzalo Aburto. I'm a Latino living here in New York. I'm the host of La Nueva Alternativa. Here at BAI, I want to ask you why Latinas and Latinos in the United States should vote for Gore and Lieberman.
I think they should vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman for several reasons. First of all, we are committed to fairness for legal immigrants, and we're trying to pass a law right now to guarantee that, and our opponents in the Republican Party are opposed to that. And the congressional leaders are opposed to it, which is another reason to vote for Al Gore, Joe Lieberman, and for Hillary, for John Corzine in New Jersey. The Latinos should know that the Democrats favor fairness for immigrants. Secondly, we favor affirmative action. Thirdly, we favor hate crimes legislation and employment non-discrimination legislation and the appointments of judges to the Supreme Court that will protect civil rights and human rights. And fourthly, let me say again, we have had an economic policy that has dramatically improved the lives of Latinos. When I became president, the Latino unemployment rate was 11.8%. Today, it is 5%, the lowest in the history of the country. So if you're looking for somebody that wants to make sure everybody is part of America's present and future, Al Gore is your man. He also proposes to put more money into the schools in the poorest parts of our country, to modernize the schools, to hire more teachers, to connect all the classrooms to the Internet. He proposes health care reforms that would provide medicine for seniors on Medicare, and more health insurance for children, and for the working parents of low-income people. The Latino working families have the highest level of uninsured people of any population group in the country. So for all those reasons, Latinos should vote for Gore and Lieberman and Hillary.
Yet despite massive protests in Puerto Rico, the U.S. Navy continues to bomb, and you've the island of Vieques, and you've authorized this.
Well, now, wait a minute. Wait just a minute now. The United States Navy has an agreement with the government of Puerto Rico, the representative of all the people of Puerto Rico, to turn back the western half of Vieques to Puerto Rico, to not have any live fire bombing. There's no live fire bombing going on there. And to terminate all the training within a couple of years, during which time they have to find a new place to train. So this training that's going on now is subsequent to an agreement. Now, the Republicans in Congress broke the agreement, and instead of giving the western part of the island to Puerto Rico, gave it to the Interior Department to manage. If I can't find a way to give that island, the western part of the island, back to the people of Puerto Rico and to honor the agreement that the government of Puerto Rico itself made with the support of the local leaders, including the mayor of Vieques, then the people of Puerto Rico, I think, have a right to say the federal government broke its word and the training has to stop right now. But I think the training should stop because the people don't want it there. Well, we need a place to train, and we're in the process of finding another place, and we made an agreement with the governor and the people of Puerto Rico and the island of Vieques for the training in the past. So I think it was a good agreement, and I think the agreement ought to be honored, and I was disappointed that the Congress didn't fully honor it, but I think I can find a way to keep the commitment of the federal government anyway, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Mr. President, what do you think about the possible amnesty for trabajadores indocumentados?
Well, I think that that's what I meant earlier. I've got a bill before Congress now that would treat legal immigrants from Honduras, from Guatemala, from Haiti, from Salvador, in the same way that the Congress has already voted to treat immigrants from Cuba and Nicaragua. I think that it's not right the way we have treated a lot of these immigrant populations differently. I know there aren't many Liberians probably among your listeners. Most of them live up in the Rhode Island, Massachusetts area, but they also were being treated unfairly, and I'm trying to get them included in immigrant fairness. And again, I'm having a big fight with the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress, so the Democrats are for that, and the Republicans aren't. So that's another reason, if you care about that, that we need to have someone to stand up to them. And that means that we need Al Gore. And if I think the Democrats have a good chance to win the House and maybe the Senate. But if we don't win, it's very important that Gore be the president, because somebody's got to be there to stop the extremist Republicans in Congress. And therefore, we need every Democratic senator we can get. We need Corzine in New Jersey. We need Hillary in New York. And we need, most important, we've got to have Gore and Lieberman in the White House.
President Clinton, UN figures show that up to 5,000 children a month die in Iraq because of the sanctions against
Iraq. That's not true. And that's not what they show. Let me just tell you something. Before the sanctions, the year before the Gulf War, you said this. How much money did Iraq earn from oil? Answer, $16 billion. How much money did Iraq earn last year from oil? How much money did they get, cash on the barrelhead, to Saddam Hussein? Answer, $19 billion that he can use exclusively for food, for medicine, to develop his country. He's got more money now, $3 billion a year, more than he had 9 years ago. If any child is without food or medicine or a roof over his or her head in Iraq, it's because he is claiming the sanctions are doing it and sticking it to his own children. We have worked like crazy to make sure that the embargo only applies to his ability to reconstitute his weapon system and his military state. This is a guy who butchered the children of his own country, who were Kurds, who were Shiites. He used chemical weapons on his own people. And he is now lying to the world and claiming the mean old United States is killing his children. He has more money today than he did before the embargo. And if they're hungry or they're not getting medicine, it's his own fault.
The past two UN heads of the program in Iraq have quit, calling the U.S. Policy, U.S.-UN policy, genocidal. What is your response to that?
They're wrong. They think that we should reward Saddam Hussein says, I'm going to starve my kids unless you let me buy nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. If you let me do everything I want to do so I can get in a position to kill and intimidate people again, then I'll stop starving my kids. And so we're supposed to assume responsibility for his misconduct. That's just not right. I know that now, you know, the truth is a lot of these people want to start doing business with Saddam Hussein again because they want his money. And, they want the money he earns from oil. But it is an absolute fact that he has more money today than he did before the embargo. So if any child is without food or medicine, it's because he has made a deliberate decision to let them die, to try to build up pressure to lift the embargo, so he can spend that money however he wants. He doesn't want to spend that money on his people. He wants to spend that money to become the military dictator of the Middle East again. Now, if people want to let him do it, that's one thing. But, you know, I have consistently supported changing and relaxing the embargo since I've been president to make absolutely sure that he had enough money and enough freedom in the use of the money to rebuild the country economically and to try to feed those children and get them medicine. There were a lot of problems with the embargo in the beginning. There were legitimate criticisms. But he now has more money with the absolute freedom to spend it on food and medicine and development and medical care of all kinds than he did before the embargo was put in. That's a fact. No one can dispute that. So nobody can figure out why there are problems among the children except that he won't spend the money on them. He spends the money on his own military, on his own crowd, and he avoids spending it on a lot of kids who need it so he can blame us, so he can actually get total control over his money so he can rebuild his apparatus.
Remember,
this is the only guy, the only world leader today who has used chemical weapons on his own citizens. And the American people, in my judgment, should give him all the money he needs to take care of his kids, but should do everything we can, and even if we're alone, to try to stop him from being in the position of murdering his kids again and murdering other children in the Middle East. That's what I believe.
Mr. President, are we going to see a substantial change in the policy through Cuba, regarding Cuba?
Well, let me say we were on the way to that change. Back in 1996, we had a lot of changes in my first term in our policy toward Cuba. And we were working our way toward a reconciliation, and the Cubans were working their way toward more openness, more freedom for their farmers and their people. We were really making headway. And then they illegally shot down those two planes, and four people died on the planes, and the Congress passed the Cuba, the Helms-Burton Bill, so-called. And I don't have much flexibility to do much more. What I have done with Cuba is to use the maximum extent of my legal powers to promote people-to-people contacts with Cuba and the Cuban people. I do believe there that the Cuban people have suffered because of the embargo, and we should do more in the area of food, in the area of medicine, the area of people-to-people contacts. I believe that it's just a question of time till the United States and Cuba are reconciled, and I think that the situation is tragic.
How do you just...
But it wouldn't have happened if Castro hadn't shot those planes down out of the air in blatant violation of international law. It was just murder. There's no way to put a fine point on it. Sometimes I think he doesn't want the embargo lifted because it's an excuse for the problems that he has with his own administration, because he knew where we were going. He knew we were moving to reconcile, and he knew good and well that it was a total violation of international law to murder people who were in unarmed airplanes.
How do you justify imposing the embargo against Cuba and lifting it against China, normalizing relations with China?
Well, first of all, China hasn't killed any of our pilots lately. They haven't murdered any Americans. As a matter of fact, the United States accidentally and tragically killed some Chinese citizens during our military campaign in Kosovo. And we have differences with China that we think can best be resolved. China is a nuclear power. We think they have missile capacity. We've worked very hard with them to reduce the threats of sales of missiles to renegade states, to make the world a safer place. And they've worked with us on peace on the Korean Peninsula to help the North Korean situation. And we would, as I said, I believe if Castro hadn't shot those planes down and the Congress hadn't passed a law which prohibits me from doing anything with the embargo, that we might have made some real progress there. But it's sooner or later this is going to happen, and the sooner the better. The sooner we can be reconciled with the people of Cuba, the better. But Mr. Castro is going to have to make some changes, and you can't keep just throwing people in jail for human rights violations and expect the United States to do nothing with this huge Cuban population here. I hope that we can make some more progress, and believe me, it would have happened if he hadn't shot those planes down. And sometimes I wonder if he shot them down just to make sure the embargo couldn't be lifted, because as long as he can blame the United States, then he doesn't have to answer to his own people for the failures of his economic policy. I wish it were different, and maybe it will be under the next administration.
Amnesty International has described what the Israeli forces are now doing in the occupied territories as...
Listen, I can't do a whole press conference here. It's election day, and I've got a lot of people and places to call.
Well, I guess these are the questions that are very important to our listeners, and these are the questions...
Well, I've answered them all.
Right, and we appreciate that. And
I have answered them all. Now, let me just tell you, on the Israeli-Palestinian thing, the Secretary General of the United Nations and I were together in Egypt. We agreed on a three-pronged strategy to end the violence and restore the peace talks. And with regard to the Amnesty International findings, what we agreed to do was to set up a fact-finding commission to look into what happened, how the recent violence started, and what can be done to avoid it recurring. And the agreement was that that would happen as soon as the violence was stopped. And we've had some progress in the last two or three days. Everybody's working hard. And I think the less I say right now, the better publicly, because I don't want to complicate things. I'm working my heart out to stop the violence, get the commission appointed, and get the peace process started. In the Middle East, which is something I know more than a little bit about, the only answer to this over the long run is an agreement that covers all the issues that the Palestinians feel aggrieved by, guarantees the Israelis security and acceptance within the region, and is a just and lasting peace. That's the only answer to this in the long run, and we've just got to work through it. I have some hope that in the next few days we'll be able to do it. Mr. Arafat's coming to see me on Thursday. Mr. Barak's coming to see me on Sunday, and we'll try to get it resolved. That's all I can tell you now, and I think the United Nations will support, I know they will, the implementation of the agreement we made at Sharm el-Sheikh.
Why not support a UN force in the Middle East for the illegal occupation of the territories? And at this point, I think we're around 150 people being killed in the occupied territories, overwhelmingly Palestinian.
You can support it if you want to, but the Israelis won't support it. And there was a war in which that happened. And if you want to make peace, then you have to do things that both sides can agree with. That's what a peace agreement is. And I do not believe that, just as I don't think Israel can forever impose their situation in the Middle East, and they don't either, which is why we started the Oslo peace process 7 years ago, neither do I think that, you know, everybody else saying the UN is going to impose their will on Israel on its own territory will work out either. We've got to have a peace agreement here. That's the only way this is ever going to be resolved. And I don't think that we should do anything or say anything right now except something that will stop people from getting killed and get the peace process started again.
Many people say that Ralph Nader is at the high percentage point he is in the polls because you've been responsible for taking the Democratic Party to the right. What do you say to listeners who are listening around the area right now?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I'm glad you asked that. This is the last question I've got time for. I'll be happy to answer that. What is the measure of taking the Democratic Party to the right? That we cut the welfare rolls in half, that poverty is at a 20-year low, that child poverty has been cut by a third in our administration, that the incomes of average Americans have gone up 15% after inflation, that poverty among seniors has gone below 10% for the first time in American history, that we have the lowest African-American, the lowest Latino unemployment rate in the history of the country, that we have a 500% increase in the number of minority kids taking advanced placement tests, that the schools in this country, that the test scores among, since we've required all the schools to have basic standards, test scores among African-Americans and other minorities have gone up steadily.
Can I say what now, some people...
Wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this. The other thing Ralph Nader says is that, you know, he's pure as a Caesar's wife on the environment. Under this administration, 43 million more Americans are breathing cleaner air. We have safer drinking water, safer food, cleaner water. We have more land set aside than any administration in history since Theodore Roosevelt. We have cleaned up three times as many toxic waste sites as the previous administrations did in 12 years. And we passed a chemical right to know law that's a very tough law. It's the best environmental record in history. Al Gore's opponent, and one of the two of them are going to be president. Al Gore's opponent has promised to weaken the clean air standards and repeal a lot of the land protections. Now, those are the facts. People can say whatever they want to. Those are the facts.
What people say is that you push through NAFTA, that we have the highest population of prisoners in the industrialized world at over 2 million, that more people are on death row in this country than anywhere else, and that people are imposed on
that's
them.
Fine, but two-thirds of the American people support that. I think there are too many people in prison, too. I have called for a total evaluation of the people in the federal prison system, a review of the federal sentencing guidelines. I did my best to persuade Congress to get rid of the discrepancy between crack and powdered cocaine in the sentencing guidelines. I agree with that. Nobody ever said America was perfect. I disagree. I think NAFTA has been good for America. I think it's been good. It has helped to reduce illegal immigration. It's helped to provide a decent standard of life in Mexico. I think it has been good. I think the agreement we made to open our markets to Africa and the poor countries in the Caribbean were good for America. People complain about our trade agreements. Trade has accounted for 30% of our economic growth, and we have the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years. How can anybody make a serious case that trade's been bad for America? We have a 15% increase in average income of ordinary Americans, the lowest unemployment rate in 30 years, and the lowest unemployment rate ever recorded among African Americans and Hispanics. Now, I don't think you can make a sane case that if we closed up our markets, that either Africa or Latin America or America would be better off.
What
the
about
the real problem you got are the results. This country's in good shape. Now, I've talked to you a long time. It's election day. There are a lot of other people
it.
In America, and I've got to go.
One okay. last question. What about granting an executive order ending racial profiling in this country?
I expect that we will end racial profiling. Here's the deal. The Attorney General is supposed to give me a report on that. I'm opposed to it. Al Gore is opposed to it. Here's the deal. Look, I had two people who worked for me in the White House who were wrongly stopped, handcuffed, and hassled the other day. I have spoken out against racial profiling, and Hillary has made it a big issue in New York. And so here's the issue, and here's what we're working on. We're trying to find a way to issue orders and rules and regulations that end racial profiling that clearly do not prevent law enforcement officials from investigating particular crimes. And there is a way to do it, and we're working on it, and the Attorney General is working on it. But, you know, Janet Reno was a prosecutor in Miami and Dade County for 12 years. She dealt with a large African-American population, a large Haitian population, a large Latino population. She had a great reputation with all of them. And she's trying to fashion a resolution of this that ends racial profiling that clearly allows law enforcement to continue. And that's where this is now. This is going to be done, and we have to do it.
Thank you for spending the time, President Clinton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Goodbye.
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 That was Mr.
Hasta la vista.
President Clinton. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you,
you are
Gonzalo.
Wonderful. Anyway,
thank you very much.
No se lo creían, ¿verdad? Decían que...
And that was the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, in an interview that we did yesterday on Pacifica Station WBAI. Gonzalo Roberto is the host of La Nueva Alternativa, which is a Latino music show on WBAI. This after President Clinton's person at the White House called, we had seconds notice saying that the president was on the line and wanted to talk about getting the vote out. Juan?
Well, Amy, I didn't see that you were very disrespectful. I mean, maybe you asked him to justify a few more things than he wanted to justify, but I thought that you, for the most part, I mean, almost exclusively your questions were to the point. I don't think he's ever had that many tough questions in a row in all of the press conferences that he's held in the White House elsewhere over 8 years.
I mean, I think it's pretty simple. It's what it sounds like when reporters refuse to go on bended knee before power.
Well, Amy, you certainly did not do that yesterday.
And that does it for today's program. We have a lot of people to thank. If you'd like a transcript of the interview with President Clinton, or you'd like to listen online, you can go to www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. You can order a cassette copy of the show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, with help from Dennis Moynihan and Craig Heimson, Brad Simpson, Jillian Aldrich, and Robert Knight. Roman Hunt at the KU Uplink, special thanks. And our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We'd love to get your comments. Call us on our comment line at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. If you'd like to comment on President Clinton's comments, again, 212-209-2999, or you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!